We're going to be discussing this morning the kingship of Ahaz, and his father Jotham, and for the next class we'll discuss King Hezekiah. Next two classes. And where I'd like to get to in the next class is the Chronicles account of King Hezekiah. That's when he restores the worship service and such. But I'd also like to go a little bit further than that. And in your handout, in the section of Hezekiah's kingship that's covered under Kings, I'd like to get into about the area of the third question, okay? So that's what I, you know, want to get done for the next class. So we'll finish Ahaz today and, Lord willing, cover the Chronicles account Wednesday night of King Hezekiah and get into about the third question of the, King's account of Hezekiah. Last week we talked about the last kings of Israel and the capture of Samaria by Assyria. This week we're going to pick up the kings of Judah who were ruling in this same time frame. Now Jotham was king before those final events in Jerusalem had happened. Jotham replaced his father, Uzziah, who, if you remember, had been struck by leprosy because he had done what? Right. And when the priest came to him to tell him to stop, he refused to listen to him, and God struck him with the leprosy. Jotham ruled in his place in the close of the 15th chapter of 2 Kings, and it's also in the 27th chapter of 2 Chronicles. And how did Jotham do before God? He did what was right. I think one thing we can say about Jotham is he learned from the mistakes of his father. Because it said that he did not enter into the temple, meaning he did not try to take over the priestly duties as his father had done. He's one that learned from his father. Know what it says concerning him in 2 Chronicles account, chapter 27 and verse 6. Why is it that he became mighty? Is this the short account we have in these two places talk about the works that he accomplished and the strength that he had, over some nations around him. What does the Chronicles account give credit for his success to? I'm sorry? Okay. The version I'm reading from, it says, he became mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord. And you can see, you know, you can see that in the lives of these kings who do, what he did, who seek to serve God, who seek to, obey the commandments of God, who seek to lead the people in righteousness. They were blessed of God. And those that did not do that were punished, and the nation was punished. So as we move into King Ahaz, we're going to see just the opposite. We're going to see someone who does not order his ways before his Lord. Ahaz is a person that I would say did not have faith. Was a faithless person. And when we talk about being faithless, what do we mean? It's an easy expression to use. We can we can talk about it in the sense of not believing. Well, and there's an element of that that's true. But Ahaz believed in God. So in what sense would he be faithless? Faith has to be to the point that it causes us to act. And when it does it, then it's in vain. And this is the idea, John, the word you use, trust, comes in. Because it will show itself in trust. It shows itself in our life. If we are a faithful person, then it will show up in the sense that we turn our lives over and to God. And when there's decisions to be made, we go to God to help us in those decisions. And the decision may not be something that would be popular on one hand. It may not be something that we can see the end, because we don't know all the turns it's going to take us through. But yet we do it anyway. We still follow the decision that our prayer and our study leads us to. He was not that type of person. Belief on an elementary scale, yes. But faith in the real sense and trust, no. And we'll see that as we go through. How does the writer of the two books, the writers, discuss the sins that Hezekiah committed and led the people into? What does it say?
Walking in the ways of the kings of Israel, mating, failed, brought his sons, working for the other nations, and they've driven out the poor.
Okay, now you reading that out of the Chronicles account? Okay. Okay. And those things, you know, are there that he did. Burning his son, the sacrifices, offerings made on the high places, the hills and under the trees, the images for the Baals. Notice also in the Chronicles account, at the close of the account, beginning in verse 24. And it says there that, what did he do to the vessels of the house of God?
Took them all out of the house of God.
Yeah, you know, took them out, cut them up, and then he shut the doors to the house of the Lord. Okay? And, he made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. It doesn't mean northeast, southwest, but just throughout the city, he made, these, altars for him to worship. Now keep something in mind as we get into Hezekiah, Lord willing, in the next class. This is what Hezekiah comes in, what it's like as far as worship unto God when Hezekiah takes over. So as you do your reading from the Second Chronicles account concerning Hezekiah, reading that account first, keep this in mind. This is the state when Hezekiah came in. The vessels of the temple are gone. The house has been shut up. It's not being used to worship God at all. And then in verse 25, in every city of Judah, not only in Jerusalem itself, but throughout Judah, he made the high places for offerings to be made to other gods. So we see something, we see on a cursory level, extent of his wickedness. But actually, until we get into the reading itself, we don't have an appreciation of just how evil he was. Now, what kings came to war against Ahaz during his reign?
Aram, the king of Aram, Israel, and the Philistines.
Okay. All right. You've got, I'll refer to that as Syria, okay, and Israel, the Philistines. Also, in your Second Chronicles account, you've got Edom. And then Assyria was also working against Ahaz and Judah. Of course, a part of Assyria was what Ahaz had done in going to them. Now, let's talk about Syria and Israel. What do the scriptures tell us about them coming against Judah? I'm sorry? You're talking about Assyria? Okay, I'm asking about Syria. And Syria and Israel. What do the scriptures tell us about them coming against Judah? Okay, it gets more specific than that. And this is because if you look in 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 5, after it's listed some of this sin that Ahaz has led Judah in, beginning in verse 5, therefore the Lord gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, and who defeated him and took captive a great number of his people and brought them to Damascus. He was also given to the king of Israel, who struck him with a great force, talking about Pekah. So you had Syria taking a great number into captivity, and then you had Pekah and Israel killing 120,000 of the soldiers. But that's not all that Pekah did. What else did he do? After he killed 120,000 soldiers, what did he do? Right. Okay. And the scriptures say took captive 200,000 of their relatives. This was a lot of people that they took captive. So they're taking these captives out of Judah up into Israel, and what happens? First off, let's go back to Old Testament law. What did the law say about one of the Israelites taking another Israelite in captivity? Not to be done. Okay, it was specifically against the law of God. So in that light, what does Obed do? A prophet named Obed. What does he do? Okay. Notice in verse 9, we're still on the Second Chronicles account, verse 28. He goes out to meet the army that's going to Samaria, says to them, behold, because the Lord, the God of your fathers, was angry with Judah. Why was he angry? Because of the sins that Ahaz was leading them in. He gave them to your hand, but notice what he says. You have killed them in a rage that has reached up to heaven. We see again this concept of God giving a nation over to someone else, but the rage in which they did it. You see, we saw this against Jehu of Israel already. The Assyrians, the Babylonians. You see, so many of these nations, it's that they relish it. You see, they take joy in it. And so the words they described here, that you've killed them in a rage. I think it was in our last meeting, there was a couple of passages that were up on a slide, and they were up for a different reason, but the slides made me think of this. In Romans chapter 1, and I think we're familiar with the context of that chapter, so I'll not go into it. But there's some terms that are used to describe the people being talked about in Romans 1. But notice in verse 31, four terms this version uses: foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. And I think those terms describe what God is talking about. They're heartless and they're ruthless. Another passage that was also used in that same lesson, matter of fact, they were both up on the slide at the same time, is over in Revelation chapter 2. And this is the letter to the church in Ephesus. Notice the wording in verse 2. This is Revelation 2 and verse 2. I know your works, your toil, your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and found them to be false. Now notice what he says in verse 4. But I have this against you, because you abandoned the love you had at first. So here was a people that are being written to that there's toil, there's endurance, they cannot bear those who are evil, they test those who call them apostles, but yet they've left their first love. So it is possible that even we can have a zeal for God, but the zeal is not properly motivated. Love is not the basis. You see, so the basis could be that we bite and devour one another. Because as we would try to uphold the truth of the gospel and maintain doctrinal purity, it may be that we lose sight of who we are. We're the children of the God of love. And love for one another gets put by the wayside. We get so enthralled in this doctrinal purity. We need doctrinal purity. And they were right to test the apostles. They needed to do that. But not, on the other hand, forget the love of their brethren, forget the love for one another. So it's possible to get so caught up that we get way out of balance. And certainly, love for the brethren has to always be among us. Because, as John wrote, how can we love God whom we've not seen when we say it? Don't love our brother who we do see. Okay, just a thought. But back to the account here. I asked you to kind of go back and look again at 2 Chronicles 11. And this was back in the days of Rehoboam, when priests and people had come from Israel I'm sorry. I looked at the wrong part of my notes. Let's move on. So certain men, after Obed talks with the people, certain men, chiefs of the cities and so forth, stand up and said in verse 13, "You shall not bring the captives here, for you propose to bring upon us the guilt against the Lord, in addition to our present sins, for our guilt is already great, and there's fierce wrath against Israel." So the armed men left the captives and the spoils before the princes and the assembly. Now notice what these men then that stood up and agreed with what Obed had said, and did not want the wrath of God brought them upon Israel any more than they were under the wrath of God. Notice how they took care of them. And you've read the details, but clothing them, food and drink, anointing them. And notice it, they said it placed the feeble on donkeys and took them to Jericho so they could meet their kin people. So this is what happened, after this battle. Well, how did Ahaz respond to all this? Now, remember, they're wanting to attack Jerusalem, but they haven't done that yet. Okay, they've attacked the cities of Judea, but not Jerusalem. So what's the response of King Ahaz? Okay, he goes to the king of Assyria. Okay, now, when we look over in the account of the Second Kings chapter 16, it appears that the king of Syria does come to his rescue. So it says in verse 9 of 2 Kings 16 that the king of Syria goes up against Damascus, takes it, carrying the people into captivity, and he kills the king of Syria. And so King Ahaz now goes to Damascus, where the king of Assyria is. And what does he see there? Now, this was a critical part of the reading, okay? This was something that in your reading should have just jumped out at you.
Treasures of the king's house.
He saw an altar.
I'm sorry?
He saw an altar.
He saw an altar. That's right. What was you saying? He saw the treasures of whose house? Well, I'm in verse 10 of chapter 16, and she's got it right. He saw the altar that was the altar of the king of Assyria.
He wanted one like it.
And so, he had it, he copied it in exact detail and sent ahead of himself, back to Jerusalem to the priest there, Uriah, for Uriah to build him one. And so Uriah did, and so it was ready for Ahaz before Ahaz returned from Damascus. So, now this speaks for the priest, you see. Whereas you had under Uzziah, when the king went in to offer sacrifice, the priest withstood him. But here you see under Ahaz, when he sends the details of this altar back for the priest to build, the priests don't withstand him. The priests go ahead and build. And so he came back and worshiped, and then it knows in verse 14, the bronze altar that's for the Lord he removed. Verse 15, he told Uzziah the priest, on the great altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening grain offering and the king's burnt offering, the grain offering, and so forth, the offerings of the people. Burn those offerings upon this altar that he had copied from Assyria. But he was going to keep the Lord's altar for what? To inquire by. And so we see the unbelievable inconsistency in their thinking. Yet they rationalized it from the concept of belief in more than one God. So in verse 16, Uriah the priest did all this as Ahaz commanded. Now, this was what the Chronicles letter is referring to when he cut up the vessels, the utensils of the, you know, the vessels and so forth, when he cut those things up, and closed the temple for worship. This is really what, I think the writer of the Second Chronicles letter was referring to. Why did all this happen? The trouble that came upon Judah is because of these things. It's because of the way Ahaz led the people. Turn, if you will, to the book of Isaiah. and turn to chapter 7. And Isaiah gives some detail now of the events that we've been talking about that are not provided by the writer of the Kings or the Chronicles. And it begins in verse 1 of Isaiah 7. In the days of Ahaz, Rezin of Syria and Pekah of Israel come up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not mount and attack against it, come up to Jerusalem. Okay, remember, the battle was in the cities of Judea, in the countryside of Judea, not in Jerusalem. They wanted to capture Jerusalem, but God did not allow them to capture Jerusalem. So they could not, as verse 1 here tells us. And obviously from verse 2, Ahaz did not have an army, because it describes how says the heart of the people shook as the trees of the forest when they heard of what Syria and Israel were trying to do. So the Lord sends Isaiah to meet Ahaz. And he tells him to send his son with him. And what is the meaning of his son's name? Did anybody see that? It may be, you know, in a reference there in your scriptures. A remnant shall return. Generally, when we think of the remnant, we think of the remnant of Israel that would come back after the Babylonian captivity. And from that remnant, even though it was not all of that remnant, but from that remnant would be the Lord's people would come. And I would say from this standpoint that should have been an encouragement to Ahaz from the standpoint of that they were not going to be destroyed. There would always be a remnant of the people of Israel. But notice what he says to him in verse 4. Notice the words. He tells him to be careful, to be quiet, to not fear, and for his heart to not be faint. How does he describe these two kings that are coming up against Judah and trying to come against Jerusalem? How does he describe them? Well, yeah, but I'm in verse 4 right now. What's being said is right, but I'm in verse 4. Now, what does that mean? Two stubs or stumps of a firebrand smoldering at that. What does that mean? Yeah, they're not that much. When you've burned a fire and it gets down to the smoldering point, your fire's about burned out, you see. And that's what this is. This is a stick that both ends have been on fire and now both ends are just smoldering. They're burning out. Okay. And he tells them in verse 5 that what y'all were saying, that he's devised evil against them in verse 6 to go up to Jerusalem, go against Judea and to terrify it. But why is it that they want to conquer Jerusalem? What's their purpose? They want to set up another man as king. It says a son of I'll call it Tabel. Now, I don't know who Tabel was. I don't know if he was of the Syrian camp or if he was of the tribes of Israel camp. I don't know who he was. Okay. There's speculation either way. But we see what their purpose was. Now, the Kings and Chronicles account don't lay this out, but their intention was to actually establish another kingship in Judah. And of course, what would that have meant for the kingship of David, for the lineage of David? It would have ended it, you see. So, their purpose. Now, I would say that that's reason enough for God to have not let that happen, okay? However, God would have had his reasons for not allowing it to happen. We can't say it's because of the evilness of Syria and Israel, because God did allow evil nations, you see, to overcome nations that weren't as evil or not thought of as evil. For instance, the book of Habakkuk addresses that. So they wanted to set up another kingship, and God would not allow that. I want us to think about the message, though, that Isaiah gives to Ahaz. Notice in verse 4, this idea of be careful, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint. When I read thoughts like that, what comes to my mind is this. There can be turmoil all around us. And there was in this case. Here they were faced with battle against two nations that were superior to them. But what does that say about what goes on inside of you? What about us? What about you?
His faith should be strong in the eyes of the pressure. Someone is trying to overcome you, you still have faith in God and His word will prevail.
Okay, Ennis, but what if God tells you that your nation is going to be destroyed? That these nations are going to come in and they are going to take over your nation. So what goes on inside of you?
You should have an attitude of repentance and trust.
But what if you're godly? I agree with that. But what if you're a godly person? You're not off into the sin that they are.
Well, it's going to be difficult because you're wondering why is this happening.
Well, I'll submit to you what Paul wrote to Timothy in the first letter, chapter 2 and verse 2. And there he talks to them about living a peaceful and quiet life. And the two terms there, and sometimes different versions, I see some of these words kind of interchanged. But one of those terms, where in verse 1, it talks about praying for kings. And we would like to have peace, you know, on the outside. We'd like to have where we can come together and worship in peace. But what if we can't? What goes on inside of us? That's the second term. Inside of us, there's internal peace. No matter what goes on outside, inside, I'm at peace because I'm at peace with God. And so I think that's a part of the message that he's given to Ahaz.
Back to a little bit later, this history. And the war was not only inevitable. Answers your question in his third chapter of those on the heart of the believers. After describing you're going to lose, your nation's going to be destroyed, and bad times coming, he said, yet I will exalt in the Lord, I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He made my feet like hinds feet, make me walk in high places. The very thing you're saying, regardless of what's going on around me, my faith will lift me up to a level.
Good point. Good point. Everybody hear that? From Habakkuk 3. Okay? And so, that's the way we need to be. And I think that's what he's saying to him. Be careful. Be careful what you do. Be quiet. Be peaceful within your heart. And do not fear. These two kings aren't going anywhere. They're not going to do what they claim they're going to do. Uh, in Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 15. Isaiah 30 and 15. For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you shall be saved. In quietness and in trust shall be your strength. The idea is we're made strong because of our trust and confidence in God. And that trust and confidence settles us. It may be turmoil within a family, as well as within a nation. It doesn't matter where the turmoil in our lives on the outside comes from. Within us, our strength is going to come from this quietness and this trust in God. And just a couple of pages over, a couple of chapters in chapter 32, in verse 17, he's talking about, I believe in this passage, he's talking about the gospel age, the age that we're in now. He says the effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness will be quietness and trust forever. As we try to live a righteous life, result of that, result of righteousness is going to be peacefulness and quietness within our own lives. And that's what this kingdom of peace that we're part of is about. It's not talking about peace between nations, between us and somebody else or whoever the countries may be. Not talking about them. It's going to be peace between us and God, but peace within ourselves because we have this peace and trust with God. Any comment or question? As we notice here in this same reading in chapter 7, notice how Isaiah is trying to encourage Ahaz to do what's right. Notice that he says, in verse 4, he tries to settle him down. Be careful, be quiet, do not fear. These two men, you know, they're on the way out. They're not gonna how the power that the words, you know, manifest. In verse 7, notice what he says. It shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. So he just says what they're trying to do is not going to happen. He tells him point blank. Verses 8 and 9, the head of Syria is Damascus. The head of Damascus is Rezin. And within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. As I look at these two verses, he's saying the borders of Israel and Syria are not going to be extended. They're where they are, and they're not going beyond their present borders. And Ephraim, at some point, the term is used 65 years, will be shattered from being a nation. Now, that would include not only their upcoming destruction by Syria, which hadn't happened at this point now. It actually happened in about the... early in the, I think it was the sixth year of Hezekiah's reign when Jerusalem is finally destroyed. We'll get into that next week, next class. But even the resettling of the people, moving them out and so forth, is probably, in my thinking, what this is referring to. So they're not going to be a nation. They're not going to be able to do the things that you say. Then notice in verse 9, he says, if you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. If you will not believe, you surely will not last. And the idea is that is for you to be firm in your faith, because if you're not, you're not going to last. Just as these nations are not going to last, you yourself are not going to last if you're not firm in your faith. Now, look at the encouragement that all these things have been offered. Now, we've talked about how kings would react to encouragement. And we're going to notice in Hezekiah how he reacted and how he even gave encouragement and the reaction to his encouragement. But this king rejected it. He rejected it all. In spite of all this, he still chose to league with Assyria. So there's a subsequent a conversation that comes up beginning in verse 10. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. And he says, ask for a sign. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. And Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. And Isaiah said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men, but you weary my God also. And the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and shall bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. So here it is that we have this great promise of the birth of the Savior, the incarnate birth, that Jesus would come in the flesh. It's not mentioned in that sense, but the term Emmanuel tells us that this is going to be one of God. So it's out of this unbelief of Ahaz that this great, great promise is given. In Isaiah chapter 49 in verse 7, Isaiah records that it would be a small thing, a small sign, a small thing for God to restore physical Israel. Then he gives a great thing. He says, rather to be a light for the nations that his salvation should reach to the end of the earth. In other words, salvation for both Jew and Gentile is something that God can accomplish. Can he bring the tribes of Israel back into relationship with him? Yes. Easy. He's going to do something greater than that. And this is what he says is great. He's going to bring all of man into a relationship with him. Ahaz said, I will not ask in verse 12, and I will not put the Lord to the test. What puts God to the test? What tests God? Can we test God?
Faithfulness test God, or lack of
it. Lack of faithfulness? Okay. Okay. And you would just think about it, you know, to kind of hone in on a little bit. To sit back and do nothing. And just wait for God to do for us. In my thinking, test God. Because we're saying, hey, I asked for it. I'm just going to sit back and wait. But like she said, Ahaz was testing God because he did not believe God would deliver. That was the reason that he went to league with Assyria. He didn't believe it. He didn't believe that they were smoldering stumps. He didn't believe that God was going to deliver them. He didn't believe that Assyria was going to be nothing and that Israel was going to be lost as a nation. He didn't believe any of that. You see, what he saw was this army of these two nations advancing, and he was afraid. And his confidence then became in how he could address that. And in that light, his lack of belief was testing God. Thanks.